two yachts. We just need some rules. Like, everyone can have a maximum of two yachts, three houses, you know, seven cars, something that we can all broadly agree to. Okay, so I see A Bronx Tale as a kid, and in the movie The Bronx Tale, there is this test, right? The car door test. And what the car door test is when you pick up a young lady for a date, you unlock her door and open the door for her and let her get into the car. And then when you walk around the back of the car, if she doesn't lean over and unlock your door before you get in the door, I mean, at this point, you kind of have to have an old car for this to even be a factor, but back when all the doors had to be unlocked manually, if she doesn't reach over and unlock that door, to quote the movie roughly, she's a bitch and you should leave right there, right? And so I saw this and it had an impact on me, and I, for my whole life, always did the car door test at the beginning of every date. And quite frankly, the car door test was always right. Like, the one girl who didn't lean over and unlock the door, like, I did not dump her right there, obviously. But she cheated on me and made me into a fool, you know? I mean, it was real, right? So I have this thing about Chaz Palminteri, like, and it goes deeper than that. I mean, he's in A Bronx Tale. I feel like he's the quintessential instinctual storyteller. Like, this guy, more than most people, was just born with it. And I mean, and that's kind of what A Bronx Tale is about. And anyways, and so I think about this guy, Chaz Palminteri, blah, 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 blah. I always watch A Bronx Tale when it's on. It's just one of those movies, like, if it's on, I'm watching it. And so anyways, I end up going to school and I go to film school, right? And well, it starts out as film school. Then I realize that my colorblindness is going to kind of hold me back. So I get a more general communications degree, a media literacy degree, but I do make a documentary, right? And I make a documentary and it's kind of good. I mean, at the time, pre-YouTube, it's really pretty good. And I send it to some contests, and I get second place in the documentary category at the Northwestern University Film Festival, right? Not that I went there, but I feel like this is even better. Like, I didn't have to pay Northwest University tradition tuition, and I'm in the contest, you know? So, like, I won the game, and I'm so excited to go, and I, like, bring someone with me, and I tell anyone I know in Chicago about my film, and, you know, I feel like it's a really big deal. And not only that, the keynote speaker for the Northwestern University Film Festival is Chaz Palminteri. So I'm excited, right? And I should have thought more about my fashion choices for the evening of Chaz Palminteri, but I was wearing a Juicy Fruits t-shirt, a yellow one, and I had a huge ponytail and a scruffy beard. But anyways, I'm really excited because I'm going to, and I do, right? It gets a question and answer period after his talk, which is really interesting. And I raised my hand and I was like, first of all, Chaz Palminteri, looking in the face, thank you so much for the car door test. Because that shit really works. And then I asked him about what it's like, you know, can I make it as a filmmaker in Iowa? And he doesn't know much about Iowa. And anyways, it kind of peters out from there. But, you know, I meet my hero and I think this is really happening. This has to be some kind of coincidence. And the next day when my film plays, I go to the auditorium and Me and the people I am with, or the people I'm with and I don't know how you say that, we are the only people there. There isn't a soul. It plays to an empty auditorium. And then I leave and I'm in the car and I'm driving back and I realize I'm out of gas. I pull over at a gas station in Evanston, Illinois, and I get mugged. And it's fine. I only have $15 on me and he doesn't like get in my car and take my camera or my tape or anything like that. But anyways, it was not exactly, I believe that's an inauspicious beginning. I think that's what you would call that. So anyways, and I am no thug. Like, I'm looking up to this Italian Bronx tale, like the story of getting involved with the mafia at a young age. And I couldn't even thwart a alcoholic schizophrenic mugger. So anyways, but Chaz Palminteri did a one-man show, and I think I'm at the point, right, where it's time for me to do a one-man show, because after that, I will know. You know, either the one-man show, the story is either the one-man show is a success, and then you establish yourself as a unrecognized entertainer, or it is a failure and it becomes a testament to your unrealistic dreams and expectations for your own life. So it's a big deal, but I got to do it. And I want to know, because the thing is, if it is a total failure, then I can just start selling something to somebody else and, you know, get on with buying a house. So anyways, what I decided to talk about today, what I've been doing is, since I am between jobs, I have been kind of cataloging my obsessions, things that come up multiple times. I make some notes and talk about them. So anyways, let's talk about the illusion of choice. One of my favorite concepts that was ever brought to me by a comedian. You know, there is some real deep knowledge always available. His name was George Carlin. You've probably heard of him. But I want to talk about the illusion of choice. And I want to talk about how to become a beer magnet or magnate. Become a beer magnet, right? Here's what you got to do. If you want to be a company like Budweiser, the first thing you have to do is create a totally unremarkable beer, right? It must be something that when somebody drinks it, they either think, "Yeah, that's pretty good," or "It still gets me drunk, I'll drink it," right? You want to get right into that zone. If you create a remarkable beer, which would be fantastic to some people and other people would be offended or thwarted, you're never going to get there to Budweiser. What you have to do is create a totally unremarkable product and then market that product with extreme and vicious ruthlessness. You know, you have to eliminate the competition. You have to buy off politicians and create the correct legislative structure to allow you to thrive. You have to put your name in every Super Bowl. I mean, it's, I don't even need to single out Budweiser. It's a fine company, I guess, whatever. You know, Miller, Coors, all those people do it. I think that it might only be Budweiser and Miller Coors now. But anyways, that is how you do it. And the only way to compete with that, of course, is you create another completely unremarkable beer, just like, you know, Miller would do. And then the two of you battle out through ruthless marketing to get people to choose something that is almost exactly like the other choice, right? There is nothing more similar to a Miller Lite than a Bud Light. All of the difference is just marketing. There's nothing more similar than those two things. There's nothing more like a Coke than a Pepsi, okay? You can't get closer to a Coke than a Pepsi. And that's kind of the story of American life. And of course, it's a political season. So now here we are once again with this intensely marketed, probably insignificant choice of choosing a president, right? Now, I personally have always preferred the Democrats' marketing strategy. It's always appealed more to my emotional needs, you know, and I like Obama. You know, I do. I like Obama. And as a matter of fact, I did something that is either quintessentially American or quintessentially somebody who is buying into false choices. And I listened to Barack Obama's book while driving across the country from Portland to Minneapolis, right? So I had this experience with Obama and his book. He read the book himself, and I feel like it gave me some insight. And the insight that I got from that book is that, I mean, it's probably the insight that I wanted to get because I learned a lot from boxing, but that Obama learned a lot from boxing, you know? I mean, because there's this part in the book, God, I hope I'm right about this because, you know, I was in quite a state driving across the country, but that his second father, when he lived in Indonesia, would take him out into the backyard and they would box. And he would talk to him about the harsh realities of third world politics and they would fight, you know, and they would fight. And I know that, I can't remember it specifically in the book, but it's got to be, I mean, like, when you become obsessed with boxing, often the road ends with Muhammad Ali, you know, he was the greatest, you know, or at least he's the most palatable and interesting choice for the greatest, you know. Mike Tyson might have been the greatest, but let's not even get into that conversation, right? And so, like, you look at the story of Ali, and first of all, he bursts onto the scene with his knockout of Sonny Liston. And I think that you can read that metaphor directly into Hillary Clinton, right? That Hillary Clinton was Obama's Sonny Liston. Like, suddenly he showed up on the scene and the fight was over before it started, right? That's like one significant part of Ali's career. Now, the second I mean, the second thing that happened, or probably the most significant thing, is that Ali refused to go to Vietnam and he got sent to prison, right? He got sent to prison. I mean, and that's really where the two roads kind of diverge, because as much as I like Obama, I feel like over this last 4 years, he had his opportunity to take his stand and he didn't take it, you know? I mean, hey, that might have been the best and most pragmatic choice, to not cause some major throwdown and get, you know, imprisoned. He is not an imprisoned ex-political leader, that's for sure. But Ali did that. And then what is the final chapter, or the kind of the moment of establishing greatness? Well, that's the rumble in the jungle, right? In this fight with George Foreman, who was the most formidable of opponents. Or really, if you had to check all the boxes, if you had to build a robot fighter, I mean, I love George Foreman, but it would be George Foreman. He hit harder than anybody else hit. He looked physically intimidating. He destroyed Frazier. He was a stone cold killer. And this might sound like a compliment, but for the purpose of this metaphor, and I just think this is true because the Ali story is so much a part of the American story. Foreman is Romney, right? Romney is the political figure that you would build if you could build one. But Romney, just like Foreman in the jungle, you couldn't tell what the fucking guy believed in. You know, you see those, I mean, watch When We Were Kings. You see those interviews with Foreman, and he just can't seem to connect with anyone. Like, he's a great fighter, but he can't connect, just like Romney. So how does Ali / Obama beat Romney / Foreman? Well, it's the rope-a-dope, of course, the rope-a-dope, where you take more punishment than anyone thinks you can possibly take, and then show that you have strength, reserves of strength that were unanticipated. And that, long story short, according to Dave Good, is what is actually happening in politics right now, is that Obama, who was schooled in boxing school, which is an ultimate human strategy kind of lesson, has taken all this abuse like he can't take it. And actually, he just threw his first punch to get out of the rope-a-dope, which is Mitt Romney is a multi-millionaire, you know? And there's been all this battling amongst the Republicans, but nobody's been able to say, which Obama can firmly say as a former college teacher, is you're a billionaire, you're a millionaire, you're the one that caused this problem. Like, eventually, by the end of the election, Romney will be, like, he might as well be dressed in a pig costume with a mouthful of money. And like, that's how this whole election is going to go down. That's how I see it. Obama gets reelected. But then, of course, nothing changes, because really both choices are nothing more than the least offensive, most generally appealing and unremarkable drink. That makes sense?
Sure did.
Yeah. Like, do you think I'm secretly talking about the apocalypse again?
No, I don't think so.
I was with you when you requested a Miller Lite and the server chastised you.
I was just thinking about that, yeah. I haven't had a Bud Light in, I don't know how long. You think they're that similar, Bud Light and Miller Lite?
Well,
you're just talking in terms of sort of quality in general.
It's hard to believe. It's one of those things, I think, like this quote, this statistic that I was going to go back to, like 80% of Americans roughly think that advertising has too much influence on culture. 80% of Americans feel like advertising has no effect on them. You know, what I've heard is that if you take a Bud Light and a Miller Lite in a taste test, people will show a true preference, or you can, you know, there's a difference between a Bud Light drinker and a Miller Lite drinker. But if you took a Bud Light, a Miller Lite, and a Coors Light and lined them all up, the variations would be exactly 33% across the board. Like, once you add that third option in, people can't tell the difference.
Huh.
So but I think, you know, that it's just really about limiting options. You know, I can't believe every time the election comes around, I just can't believe what the choice is. The choice always seems so lousy. And yeah, at this time, I'm personally more fine with Obama than I have been with most candidates. Mm-hmm. But
My admiration for him has never diminished.
Yeah, I like him too. I like him too. I mean, it's not like Bush-Kerry, where like I like was like, I gotta go vote for Kerry because I have no choice. Mm-hmm. And I think Republicans are feeling that way.
Mm-hmm. You almost have to feel for Republicans.
I do. I totally do.
It's just such a loony, just a sideshow. Not a sideshow. I guess it's the main show. But
yeah.
A freak show?
Well, and the thing is, there's like, there really should be no almost about it. I mean, that I believe in a world where there's an opposition candidate, you know, like, and I think that people need to think that through sometimes more, where it's like, yeah, this is what I believe, but I don't really want to live in a world where what I believe is the only option, because people who think differently than me.
Yeah, that's very generous of you.
Well, I mean, it's just the truth. Like, yeah, I'm not the end all be all. But yeah, I mean, too bad. I mean, Perry, what's weird is I think that Perry is actually a more capable politician than George Bush was, but for some reason people are more savvy to the stupidity now and they won't take it. Like, I thought there was no way.
He has just utterly imploded, hasn't he?
Yeah, he really has.
I mean, he seemed, once upon a time, he seemed to be, he sort of took, he rode in and kind of took over for a couple of weeks,
yeah,
didn't he?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really see it as factions, you know. It was like he was the best hope of the Texas faction, which is like a major faction and is capable of winning. But right now the billionaire faction is the leading faction. You know, the corporate Wall Street billionaires, their candidate is the one that, you know, they're pushing forward. And Newt Gingrich is just like a rogue agent, you know, and which I like. I mean, I'm enjoying seeing him. I mean, I like how Gingrich will unabashedly contradict himself and then be insulted. Like, he's clearly just like playing a hilarious game with the world, and all he's doing is amassing power, and like all we have to do to stop him is just turn away the cameras, but we'll never do that. And, you know, I mean, I have some respect for the devil that he is.
Yeah, he's never less than interesting.
Yeah, oh no, I mean, he's
got some flavor to him.
Yeah, he's got some flavor. He'll say whatever, whenever, but weirdly you feel like he's got a secret agenda, where it seems like Romney doesn't have a secret agenda, and that's what's frightening.
that's heavily ironic.
Yeah, it's like Gingrich seems to have some kind of crazy secret agenda, but we can respect that because we understand that motivation. Right. We can work with that. Whereas Romney, it just like seems like it's just all piles of cash. And, you know, that was the other thing I was thinking about Romney today, and just in general, like, I believe that, you know, if your dream is to sail on a yacht, I want you to sail on a yacht. If your dream is to have an apartment in Paris, you know, have an apartment in Paris. But once you get to the point where you're just like buying additional residences and additional cars, you got to look yourself in the mirror a little bit, you know. Why don't you share you can feed starving people, you can like help a poor person start a business, you can save a rainforest, you know. Like, at some point you got to look at yourself in the mirror and say, that's too many houses, or, you know, just what kind of game are you playing? That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying I don't want, if somebody wants a yacht, I want them to have a yacht. What's more expensive than a yacht, you know? But just, you got to draw the line.
Two yachts.
Yeah, right? Two yachts. We just need some rules. Like, everyone can have a maximum of two yachts, three houses, you know, seven cars, something that we can all broadly agree to. And then it's like, okay, you've got your three houses, two yachts, seven cars. You have to give someone else a chance. Give someone a leg up. It will feel good. You know, that's the thing, is it will feel good. It'll make you actually feel better, rather than that dark hole of prostitutes and yachts you're drowning in.
You've been listening to The Dave Good Show.